All right, our recorder's up and running. Page 118 in your exegetical outline notes, chapter 5, verse 31. Where are we in our review? Remember, we're still in the prophet's present time. This is the court of Belshazzar, and it'll also be the court of Darius the Mede, the prophet's present time, Daniel's present. We're in a section of scripture that is chiastically linked. And in chapter 5, we're dealing with the idea of encouragement. Encouragement for the Jewish community during the times of the Gentiles. And you remember in chapter 5, Belshazzar, under siege in Babylon, during a feast, decided to throw a big party for his nobles, and did so, and he made a big mistake. He desecrated the implements used in the temple at Jerusalem. And God said, well, that's enough time for judgment for Belshazzar. And so he sent this hand, and this hand wrote code on the wall. And we don't know if it looked exactly like this. This is the traditional Jewish anagram, or one of the traditional Jewish anagrams of that Aramaic statement. And the Aramaic was interpreted by Daniel. Remember, the other wise men couldn't do it. The queen mother came in and said, there's a solution. I've got this guy, Daniel, who can do it. Daniel came in and he interpreted the writing. Mene, mene, you have the limit of your kingdom has been determined, and those appointed to bring it to an end have come. Mene, mene. And the people appointed to bring it to an end was named. The person was named. Cyrus the Persian in Isaiah 44:28 and in Isaiah 45 verse 1. He was named 150 years prior to this event by Isaiah. Well, Cyrus did come in and took over Babylon. So, mene, mene, tekel, you have been weighed on the balances and found wanting. Upharsin or peres, remember the little word play. Your kingdom has been peres, divided, and given to paras, the Medes and the Persians. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. That was the judgment upon Belshazzar. And I gave you this slide as well of the actual script of that message. We saw that the fall of Babylon was also predicted by Isaiah the prophet in Isaiah 21, again 150 years before it happened. In this edited version of Isaiah 21 verses 1 through 10, we saw that first of all, Medo-Persia was named, Elam, another name for Persia. Go up, Persia, lay siege, Media. They were to lay siege to Babylon, and what was happening in Babylon is described very clearly. They set the table, they spread out the cloth, they eat, they drink. It was party time in Babylon. And then suddenly comes the cry of alarm. Rise up, captains, oil the shields. Cry of alarm because the enemy is coming into the city. As Daniel was interpreting the writing on the wall, the Medo-Persians were entering the city. And so the next voice says, fallen, fallen is Babylon. Babylon goes down to the Medo-Persians. We also took a look at secular history, Herodotus, the Greek historian, and he told us that Cyrus placed part of his soldiers where the Euphrates River entered the city of Babylon, and then he placed another party of his frontline soldiers where the river exited the city of Babylon. Then he took the rest of his army north, and they diverted the river of Babylon into a lake. And he gave orders that as soon as the river is low enough to wade, go ahead and enter Babylon. And that's exactly what happened. In the night, the river got down to about thigh level, knee level. And so the Medo-Persian soldiers then attacked. They entered the city of Babylon by walking up the riverbed and going through the small gates that all line this major wall here. The Babylonians were so confident that they were safe. They hadn't closed those gates. They weren't watching the gates, and Herodotus tells us if they were, they would have cut down the Medo-Persian soldiers. But as it was, the enemy entered the city, and the city basically fell without a fight. All right. So that brings us then to chapter 5, verse 31, on page 118, the very last verse of chapter 5. And I didn't want to go over this verse last week because it's a controversial verse. Critics of the book of Daniel and critics of the Bible like to use this verse to state that Daniel and these people he mentions are all myths, nothing that really existed. So let's take a look at this final verse, chapter 5, verse 31. Verse 31, everybody there and all set? All right, verse 31. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. And again, this guy's identity is highly debated. And the critics love to say, well, Darius the Mede never existed. He was a myth, and so the book of Daniel is a myth as well. Well, let's see what the Bible has to say, first of all, and then we'll take a look at history. Point A at the top of the page, the person, Darius the Mede. It says that, the scripture says that he received the kingdom. That would mean he got it from a higher authority. Someone else gave it to him. Well, that higher authority would be point B, Cyrus the Great. Cyrus is the emperor of the emerging Medo-Persian Empire. And so he gave Darius the Mede the kingdom. And this would be the province of Babylon. Now, when this happened, is the age of Darius is noted there, when Darius is 62 years old. Now, I don't really know why God felt it was important to mention Darius' age here. Every commentator that I looked at, Jewish and non-Jewish, really didn't have much to say or anything to say about that. All we can say is that he was born 4 years before the second deportation in 597. So he was born just before the second deportation of Judah by the Babylonians in 597. So that's all we learn from the verse 531. But if we look at historical records, we can piece together who this guy was. So I'll review a little bit of the information that we went over last week. Now, critics point out that Darius the Mede is not mentioned in historical records as conquering Babylon. That's their main objection. Darius the Mede is not mentioned in the historical records that we have as conquering Babylon. But the historical records that we do have, I believe, helps us to solve the problem, who is Darius the Mede? So let's work through points 1 through 8. First of all, like last week, we learned that Babylon was conquered by General Ugbaru. He was the governor of Gutium, and I'm not sure what Gutium was. It either was a city or a province in Persia. I'd have to look that up. I haven't bothered to look that up. But this is General Ugbaru. Point two, General Ugbaru led the army of Cyrus and entered Babylon the night of the feast. That's very clear. Point three, the co-regent, Nabonidus, the king, he was the father of Belshazzar. Nabonidus, the co-regent, had fled Babylon the night before. Remember, he came back from Tama in Arabia to fight the Medo-Persians and was defeated. He fled, was eventually captured, and died in exile. That we know. Point four, we also know that Babylon fell on October 11th, 539. We know the exact date of the conquer, when it was conquered. Now, point five, Emperor Cyrus had already conquered the city of Opis. So point five tells us that Cyrus and his troops, this would be the main body of his troops that had gone north, remained in Opis and only arrived in Babylon 18 days later, October 29th, 539. So he arrives in Babylon quite a bit after it had been taken. And this is not unusual for the emperor to be in a different location and send his general down to conquer a particular city. This is not unusual. So Cyrus appears on the scene 18 days later, and then, point six, Gubaru is appointed governor of Babylon. Gubaru. He reigned from 539 to 525. Point seven, 8 days after Cyrus arrives, General Ugbaru dies. He dies 26 days after conquering the city of an illness of some sort. That's about all we know. Now, the problem arises in point eight, that in the Greek accounts, probably Herodotus here, both Ugbaru and Gubaru are named Gubrius. And so this has led to confusion, some thinking that Ugbaru and Gubaru are the same guy. But I think it's very clear that they are different people. Governor Gubaru governing Babylon for 14 years, General Ugbaru dying 26 days after conquering Babylon. Okay, does that make sense? All right, basically a repeat of last week. All right, next page. Page 119. Top of the page. All right then, Bob. Well, who in the world is Darius the Mede? Point C, top of the page. Well, there are two options. Commentators take two positions based on the evidence. Some commentators say, well, it may be Cyrus, a second name for Cyrus. So Cyrus and Darius the Mede are the same guy. And they base this on Daniel 6:28, point A. Now, this is Daniel 6:28, as all major translations translate the verse. Daniel 6:28. When we get there, you'll see this is the way it's translated in the NASB. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian, indicating clearly they're two different individuals. Very valid translation of the Aramaic. But other commentators, not translators here, commentators render the verse differently. Some commentators render the verse this way. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius, even Cyrus the Persian, making Darius and Cyrus the same individual. Two different names for the guy. And so that rendering is point B on your outline. But I think if we look at secular history, look at Herodotus, what Herodotus says and others, it's better to see Darius and Cyrus as two different people, just as it's better to see Ugbaru and Gubaru as different people. All right, so that's one option, not a strong option. The second option, point two, is the better option. Darius and the Mede is the same as Gubaru. Governor Gubaru. In fact, here he is. Here is Darius the Mede, Governor Gubaru, who ruled Babylon for 14 years. Now, we know this guy was born in 601 to Ahasuerus, who was a Mede. So that's correct. We learn in Daniel 5:31 and, as you see in point B, Daniel 9:1, that he's appointed governor of Babylon. And he became the de facto king because Cyrus withdrew from Babylon that same year. Cyrus didn't hang around in Babylon. He had other territory to conquer. So he left Darius the Mede in charge of Babylon to govern it. Now, I want you to notice some things on this relief. You see him there sitting on his throne. Here's his footstool. He's got his staff and his rod. This would be his rod and his staff, both symbols of his authority. And he's got a real great hairdo, doesn't he? He must have spent hours in the hairdresser. Who's his stylist? Yeah, man, he loved his hair, didn't he? Think I had to do that? Grow my beard down here like that, get it all curled? Nobody's saying yes. You don't want me to do that. Okay. Yeah, he loved his hair there. The Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians love long hair. But what I want you to notice is, first of all, that his hand here and the rod have been chipped off, have been defaced. And look at, his nose is missing, right? Why would that happen? Well, the reason that that would happen is because somebody deliberately took an axe to those features. And they did that to humiliate the former king. Because if you defaced his face, his visage, his face, that was dishonoring to him. And if you defaced the symbol of his authority, you were saying, I no longer respect you, you're defeated king. So as you look, when you look at, when I show you reliefs like this, and when you see them in museums, or when you see them in books, Biblical Archaeology Review or historical books, especially busts, you'll notice that the schnoz is gone. Look at it. Over and over and over again, you'll notice the schnoz is gone. Why? You know, I always thought, well, it just sticks out too far, it got knocked off. But no one knows. That's one. Kibbutz for you, buddy. It's coming. But that is deliberate. When you see those busts of Caesar or other officials and their nose is broken off, that's because some conqueror has come in or somebody who succeeded them has come in and taken a hammer and whacked their nose off in order to deface their image and therefore humiliate them and communicate this guy's no longer in charge. That's what's happened here as well. No nose. I know it. All right. All righty. Now, it appears that the title Darius, that the word Darius, I should say, it appears that the word Darius is a title rather than a name. For example, here we're talking about Darius the Mede. And we come across this term in Daniel 6, Daniel 11. He's called the son of Ahasuerus, Daniel 9:1, Darius the Mede. But we also run across Darius, the son of Hystaspes, who lived in 521. And this shows up in Ezra 5:1 in a number of places, and Ezra chapter 6 in a number of places. And we run across Darius the Persian, who lived from 424 to 404. This shows up in Nehemiah 12:22. And history tells us there may be one other Darius associated with Scripture, and that would be Darius III Cotomanus, the last king of Persia. So you see this name Darius shows up over and over and over again, probably a title rather than a name. Okay, is anybody copying these down?
Yes.
You're copying down. So we'll pause for a moment here. Darius the Mede, Darius the son of Hystaspes, Darius the Persian, Darius III Cotomanus. Okay? So this would indicate that Darius the Mede is the same as Governor Gubaru. That would be, Darius would be his official title. Gubaru would be his personal name. All right, make sense? So there's no real reason to doubt the book of Daniel. There's very reasonable explanations for all this criticism that comes to us from unbelieving critics. I want to render the book of Daniel as a myth. All right. Can I move on? Yes? Yes?
Yes.
Okay. Point 3 in the middle of the page. What lessons can the Jewish community learn from chapter 5 that will bring comfort to them? The basic lesson here is that all the Gentile kingdoms are destined to fall during the times of the Gentiles. And that's exactly what the image of Nebuchadnezzar taught us as well. Babylon. Here's an illustration of Babylon falling to the Medo-Persians, falling to the Greeks, falling to the Romans, falling to the Messiah. All the kingdoms, all the Gentile kingdoms will fall during the times of the Gentiles. And the most magnificent of them all, the Babylon, was the first. Now, Dr. Walvoord has some comments in his commentary that I think are worth noting. Dr. John Walvoord in his commentary writes, "In many respects, modern civilization is much like ancient Babylon. resplendent in its monuments of architectural triumph. First thing I thought of there when I read it was the Dubai Tower, right? The highest building in the world now in Dubai, basically empty. They can't afford to fill it with offices. But that's an architectural triumph, huh? As secure as human hands and ingenuity could make it, and yet defenseless against the judgment of God at the proper hour. When God moves, your kingdom is over. Even if it is a Dubai, it has a Dubai tower. Okay? Contemporary civilization is similar to ancient Babylon in that it has much to foster human pride, but little to promote human security. Much as Babylon fell on that 16th day of Tishrei, October 11th or 12th, 539 BC, as indicated in the Nabonidus Chronicle, so the world would be overtaken by disaster when the day of the Lord comes, 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 through 3. The disaster of the world, however, does not overtake the child of God. Daniel survives the purge and emerges triumphant as one of the presidents of the new kingdom in chapter 6. That's the encouragement to the Jewish community. And that also should be an encouragement to us as well, because the day of the Lord will come, the tribulation period will come, but those of us in the church will survive, and the tribulation believers will survive, and we will all enter the Messianic kingdom together. Same thing. Same principle, right? Of course, right. All righty, that's the encouragement for Israel. Israel will survive. All right, guess what? Chapter 6. We finally made it. Chapter 6, page 120. All right, as far as the time frames go, we're still in the present time. This time we are in the court of Medo-Persia with Daniel. Daniel's present time in the court of Darius the Mede. We are in that chiastically linked section of chapters, but now we come to point B prime, where we look at another chapter warning the Jewish community that persecution will come during the times of the Gentiles, chapter 6. So just be ready for it. Be ready for it. Now, this chapter is also chiastically constructed. And Dr. Constable, in his notes, laid that all out for us. So in order to save my life, I am handing you this handout with that overview and outline of chapter 6. And we'll go through it very quickly. Northern Kingdom. Can I get a volunteer here? There we go. Thank you, Craig. All righty. We'll go through this overview of the chapter real quickly. Let's see, did you guys get it? No. Okay. There we go. We'll go through this overview quickly, and you'll also get a peek at the chiastic instruction as well. And I'm just trying to familiarize you with this literary device, because it's very common in Scripture. And if you recognize the literary device, then you'll recognize what's happening in that body of Scripture. You'll see that he's repeating. We need one. Any extras here? Any extras here? Okay. Extras here. Oh, here we got some extras. Here you go, Craig. There you go. There you go. Right. Whoops. Got it? Whoops. Okay. Any other extras? And there's one there, one there. Okay. We do have a good number left over. And again, they will be in the notebook up to the front if you want to grab copies for other people. Okay, everybody in the Northern Kingdom taken care of? Great. Thank you, Craig. All righty, let's go through chapter 6 and take a quick high-speed overview of the chapter. First of all, point A, the chapter will start with an introduction describing Daniel's success in verses 1 through 3. Point B, Darius will sign an injunction, and Daniel will take his stand in verses 4 through 10. Point C, Daniel's colleagues will plan his death, verses 11 through 15, because he takes his stand. Point D, Darius hopes for Daniel's deliverance, verses 16 through 18. And now the chiasm starts. D prime. Darius witnesses Daniel's deliverance. He first hoped for it, now he witnesses it. C prime. Daniel's colleagues meet their death rather than Daniel dying. They planned his death, but now they meet their death. B prime. Darius will sign a decree and take his stand. Previously, Darius signed an injunction and Daniel took a stand. And finally, point A prime, a conclusion, Daniel's success again. So that's the flow of the chapter, real quick-like. Make sense? All righty. All right, let's take a look then at Daniel in the lion's den, probably one of the most famous sections of Scripture. You all got this story when you were in Sunday school, right? And even if you didn't go to Sunday school, you probably got it. All right, point A, page 120. We begin with the position of Daniel in the new government. Point one, verses 1 and 2 deal with the organization of the new kingdom. And notice, this is the organization for the province of Babylon only. Babylon or Babylonia is now only one province in the Medo-Persian Empire. And the city is no longer the capital city of the empire. Here's the Medo-Persian Empire, and the province of Babylon is in this area here. The city of Babylon is simply the capital of that province, no longer the capital of the whole empire, right? Because this is now the Medo-Persian Empire. So Darius was made king over this particular province, the province of Babylonia. All right, how does Darius organize his province, his kingdom, as it's called here? Verse 1, chapter 6, verse 1. It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom. So he sets up the bottom level of provincial government. This is the bottom level, pretty much, the 120 satraps. So there were some 120 divisions to his province. He chopped it up fairly finely. So here we got the 120 satraps. Then above them, we learn about three presidents in chapter 6, verse 2, first part of verse 2. And over them, three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them. That's just the American Standard Translation. That's just the word they chose in 1901. The NASB, of course, calls them commissioners. Yeah. Government officials, you know, whatever title we want to give them. All righty. So this is the next level up, the commissioners. And Daniel was one of these three men. So they're all co-equal at this point. So we have the point two, the satraps responsible to the commissioners or presidents. The commissioners responsible to Darius. Darius responsible to Cyrus. So here is the government from the top down. From the top down. You got Cyrus, the emperor. Darius the Mede, who is over the kingdom of Babylonia. Cyrus the emperor over the entire empire. Darius over the province of Babylonia or Babylon. Under him, three commissioners. One of them is Daniel. Under them, 120 satraps. Okay? Pretty straightforward stuff. Now, why were they organized in this way? The purpose for this organization, last part of the verse, and that the king might not suffer loss. So point two, point C2, there to supervise the province and avoid problems for the king in the areas of taxation, organization, and financial safeguards. You know, every political leader wants his taxes to come in, and he wants order in his kingdom. So these guys were there to be the PRS, or I guess the BRS, the Babylonian Revenue Service. Right? All right. Now, Daniel, however, percolates to the top, as do so many of the biblical characters. Remember Joseph? When he was a slave in Potiphar's house, what happened? He percolated to the top, and before you knew it, he was in charge of Potiphar's house. Then he got thrown into prison. He was just another prisoner, but he percolated to the top, and before you knew it, he was in charge of the prison. Okay? Well, the same thing's going to happen to Daniel, so we'll pick that up after the break. So go ahead and take your break, and when you hear the shofar, weekly blown, then come on back. All right, we're underway again. All right, we're in the middle of... We're in the middle of page 120, point 2 on your outline, the superiority of Daniel. He is now going to percolate to the top of the government. Or I should say higher up in the government. Verse 3 then, chapter 6, verse 3, the superiority of Daniel. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. So Daniel gets noticed by Darius. He stands out above the other two presidents or commissioners, point A. He stands out above all the satraps, the 120 satraps. Now, why? Why does he stand out? Scripture says an excellent spirit was in him. That word excellent means to be outstanding, to be exceptional. So Daniel was very different. Outstanding, exceptional. He had age, he had experience, and he was completely trustworthy. Age, experience, and completely trustworthy. Yeah, he's about his 80s or so now. So he stands out because of this. So what does Darius do? Darius notices him, and Darius says, I think I'm going to create a new governmental position. I'm going to create a new position, and I'm going to put Daniel in that slot. So that's the idea behind point one. He wants to set him over the whole realm. That's the province of Babylonia. He wants him over the province of Babylonia, and this would put him over the two presidents. So the new plan now is up on the screen. We have the old plan, and now here's the new plan. We have Cyrus, the emperor. He's over the entire Medo-Persian Empire. Then we have Darius the Mede. He's over the province of Babylonia. Now we have Daniel accountable to Darius. I'm calling him prime minister, or whatever you want to call him. And then he's over now who? The two commissioners. See, these guys have in a sense been demoted. They're down here, and now they're over the 120 satraps. So this is the new governmental organization of Babylonia. Okay, make sense? Guess what? What happens when you have a couple of corrupt, ambitious men who are displaced? They get a little bit upset, don't they? Come out with a new what? New medical plan. All right. The plan leads to this little problem. And the little problem's page 121. The conspiracy. Top of page 121. Actually, two conspiracies. Actually, two. One will fail. One will succeed. So these two guys right here, these two guys are ambitious. They're not only corrupt, they're very ambitious. And they want to remove a roadblock to their success. They, of course, want the prime minister position now. They'll do anything they can to get it. But they also want to remove a roadblock to their corruption. And so we start with the first conspiracy in chapter 6, verse 4. Chapter 6, verse 4. Then the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, insomuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. All right. They first try to accuse him of misusing his position, and the result is failure. Point one, they can find nothing against him. And believe me, you guys, when you run for public office here in America, the media goes everywhere trying to find something wrong with you, right? They'll go through your garbage to try to find some accusation against you, believe me. Well, that's what these guys did with Daniel. You better believe they went through all his records. They went through everything personal. They went through his garbage. They went through everything to try to find something they could accuse him of. And they didn't do it. They couldn't do it because, point A, Daniel was faithful. He was above reproach. He was incorruptible. But you know what happens when a person is incorruptible? They make corruption impossible. And that sets off people who want to take advantage of the system, doesn't it? An incorruptible person is a roadblock because he will deal with that corruption properly. He'll report it or he'll stop it. Now, corruption is just a fact of life in the Middle East. It has been in the past. It was during Daniel's day. It is a fact of life today. The old bakshish plan. You know, you want to get somewhere, you just grease the palm of the official, a little bakshish, and then you get what you want. That's the system in the Middle East today. And we get a nice example of it in this article in the Jerusalem Post that came out last month called The Fatah Fairy Tale. And by the way, this is Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority. Well, this is just an interesting little article I ran across that talks about being incorruptible and how a person who is not corruptible stops corruption. It's about Fahmy Shabani. The PA, the Palestinian Authority, put him in charge of a unit responsible for investigating corrupt activities carried out by PA officials. Well, they knew very well what was happening. Shabani collected massive amounts of information on senior PA officials detailing their illegal activities. These activities included the theft of hundreds of millions of dollars in international aid, just like Yasser Arafat did. He died a multimillionaire on American taxpayer money. Okay, thefts of hundreds of millions of dollars of international aid, illegal seizure of land and homes, monetary and sexual extortion of their fellow Palestinians. Over time, Shabani became disillusioned with his boss. The man is starting to act like a Daniel. Abbas appointed him to his job around the time he was elected PA head in 2005. Abbas ran on an anti-corruption platform. They knew what was going on. Everybody knows about this stuff. It's no secret. Yeah, this is why Fatah is a fairy tale. Yeah. Shabani's information demonstrated that Abbas presided over a criminal syndicate posing as a government. And that's exactly what Yasser Arafat had. He had a criminal syndicate posing as a government. And Abbas just took over from him when he died. And yet, rather than arrest his corrupt criminal associates, Abbas promoted them. Abbas continued promoting his corrupt colleagues even after Hamas's 2006 electoral victory. That win owed a significant degree to the widespread public revulsion with Fatah's rampant corruption. Like I said, everybody knows what's going on here. I don't see why they supposedly try to hide it. Recently, Shabani decided he'd had enough. The time had come to expose what he knows. But he ran into an unanticipated difficulty. No one wanted to know. As he put it, Arab and Western journalists wouldn't touch his story for fear of being punished by the PA. In his words, Western journalists don't want to hear negative things about Fatah and Abbas. Lacking other options, Shabani brought his information to a Jewish newspaper. Oh, yeah! He was desperate, believe me, to the Jerusalem Post's Khaled Abu Tawami. Khaled Abu Tawami is I hope I pronounce his name correctly, is an Israeli Arab who's a writer on the Jerusalem Post. On January 29th, the Post published Abu Tawami's interview with Shabani on our front page. Among other impressive scoops, Shabani related that Abbas's associates purloined $3.2 million in cash that the U.S. gave Abbas ahead of the 2006 elections. That's our taxpayer money. $3.2 million in our taxpayer money. We paid for that. He stole from us, you guys. We want it back. I agree. And this was before the election, which Abbas lost. He told Abu Tawami how PA officials who were almost penniless in 1994 now have tens and even hundreds of millions of dollars in their private accounts, just like Yasser Arafat. I believe his wife lives in Libya now in the lap of luxury. He related how he watched in horror as Abbas promoted the very officials he reported on. I can just see Abbas saying, oh, purloined $1 million. Good job. Ah, purloined $2,100 million. Good job. Let's promote this guy. No? All right. Enough of this. As for Abbas and his cronies, they were quick to blame the Jews. It's always the Jews' fault. They accused Shabani, their trusted henchman, when it came to land sales to Jews, of being an Israeli agent. All right. My point. Shabani began to act incorruptibly, and so he exposed this corruption. Daniel was an incorruptible person. He was willing to expose corruption, and he would be hated. Hated. Okay? Nothing's changed over thousands of years. All right? Make sense? Just like Shabani, Daniel would be hated. Yes? I haven't heard of him being killed, no. He's probably under some kind of protection. He's probably in a European country or the United States by now. Yeah, he'd be a marked man. Oh, yeah. We got to kill this Israeli agent. All right. So Daniel was faithful, point A. Point B, they could find no error or fault in all his dealings. And you know, don't you wish our public officials were like Daniel? Some are. Some are. We can't paint everybody with the same brush. But you know, have regular scandals in our political system, don't we? Regular scandals. Both parties, no matter what level, happens all the time. Very few Daniels in the American government. All right. Point C. Notice point C. He had a good testimony to his position. Okay, he worked for this pagan idolater who worshiped pieces of stone and metal. And he didn't hold his tongue. He was faithful to his employer. He served him well, and it showed. And, you know, the application to us is, are we faithful to our employers, no matter who they are, good or bad? You know, I've had one really bad employer. Most have been okay. One was really good, and one was really bad. You know, been there, done that. No. He was not a Christian. The really good one was not a Christian either. The really bad one was not a Christian. The ones in the middle, yeah, they, the ones in the middle were okay. Some were Christian, some weren't. All right. But, you know, in spite of the fact of the what our boss is like, we need to be faithful to our position. That's what Ephesians 6, 5, and 5 through 8 tells us. You know, we have to be a Daniel. And this is what Paul is basically responding to. This is nothing new. He knows the book of Daniel. He says, slaves, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in the sincerity of your heart, as to the Messiah, not by way of eye service as men pleasers, but as slaves of the Messiah, doing the will of God from the heart. With good will, render service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good thing each one does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether slave or free. That's what Daniel did with his employer, a pagan idol worshiper. And we need to do the same thing as well. The book of Proverbs encourages us to do that. The hand of the diligent will rule, but the slack hand will be put to forced labor. So we need to be diligent in our jobs. We need to be serving the Lord primarily, and we need to be diligent. You know, I was in a color shop once in Portland, Oregon, and we had a scanning department. That department would scan the transparencies that came in, and then we'd get those negatives for those color separations, and I'd take them from there. But we got a new guy in the scanning department, and after he'd been there for about a month or two, he wasn't liked very well. And one of the other scanners, he was on the night shift, and one of the day shift came up to him and said, he said, listen, slow down. You're putting out too much work. You're making the rest of us look bad. You see, he was diligent. He cranked out more negatives and assignments on night shift than the day shift guys did, and they resented it. That's what happens when you're diligent. The lazy workers are not going to appreciate it. But we're to be diligent because we're working for the Lord. Daniel was diligent, and the other presidents don't like it. Proverbs 22:29. Do you see a man skilled in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before obscure men. So here's an encouragement to do a quality job. This is why Daniel percolated to the top. That's the principle of Proverbs 22:29. You got to do a quality job. You got to do a diligent job. You're working for the Lord primarily, not for that rotten boss. That's sometimes hard to remember. Sometimes that's hard to remember. And finally, final encouragement comes from the Lord himself in Matthew 25:21. In the parable of the talents, the master says to his slave, his master said to him, well done, good and what? Faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. So God gives us jobs to do here on earth. They're little things. If we're faithful in those things, our reward will be greater responsibilities in the kingdom. Okay, because this is just sinful planet Earth, you guys. This is the little stuff. We have to be faithful down here with what God gives us, okay? And look forward to what he will give us in the kingdom. All right. Enough of that. Let's be Daniels. Yes. And Micah 6:8 says, mercy. Good. Good cross-reference. Micah 6:8. Okay. All right. Daniel is a good testimony to his position. So they can't find anything wrong with him. The first conspiracy fails. They move to a second conspiracy in verses 5 through 8. They do find one possible area of accusation in verse 5. Then these men said, we shall not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. All right, they're not able to find anything political against him. So they turn to the religious and spiritual realm, and they see that the only option they have is to force Daniel to either compromise his faith or disobey a political command. That's the only option they have. What does this tell us? This tells us that Daniel let his light shine at work. Daniel didn't hide that he was a believer in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Neither should we. Neither should we. Daniel didn't go along with the idol worship. I don't want to offend anybody. I'll just, you know, bow down a little bit here. Or I'll just keep my mouth shut when we talk about spiritual things. Daniel let his light shine. They knew what he believed in. And that's true for us as well. We should influence those around us in our neighborhoods, in our families, at our place of work. You know, when I interviewed for jobs in the printing industry, I was in the printing industry for 15 years. When I interviewed, I would tell them, listen, you guys, I am a Christian. There are some types of work I cannot do. So if you specialize in this kind of work, don't even bother to give me the job. You know, I had to do that. Just so they know right up front. And I've had to turn down a few jobs that came in. Say, no, sorry, I'm not going to work on this. Okay? We got to do that, you guys. You got to serve the Lord first. You got to let your light shine. That's what Yeshua tells us, Matthew 5, verses 14 through 16. You are the light of the world. If we don't shine, where's the light going to be? It's going to be a dark world, a dark family, a dark place of employment, a dark neighborhood. He says, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Okay, he doesn't say take a spotlight and shine it in their eyes so they're blinded. He says, you know, shine in a gracious way. So that means we need to be polite and respectful when we do shine, okay? That's the way I had to be with my bosses. I'm sorry, I just can't do this job. You know, assign it to somebody else, please. You know, I trembled when I did that. I was fully expecting, well, Morris, out of here. Here's your 2 weeks' notice, you know? You just do it in a polite way. Let your light shine in the proper way. Daniel did. They knew what he believed. All right. Knowing what he believes, they're able to formulate this accusation and this plan against him. So we begin in chapter 6, verse 6, with the assembling of the conspirators. Verse 6. Then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows. King Darius, live forever. So point A, probably the two presidents and some of the satraps. We don't really know how many. Probably those in the vicinity of Babylon proper, because the whole province was pretty good sized. So probably not all of them, but the presidents would be the ringleaders. They address the king in the proper way. And then it says, point C, they assembled together. Sounds kind of innocuous. But the verb emphasizes eagerness and enthusiasm. So they come in concert like a cheerleading squad. You know, king, we just got this great idea we know you're going to love. And all of them are just there. Yeah, king, oh man, we can hardly wait to come and let you know about this. So they're doing this for psychological impact. They want to put pressure on the king. They want to coerce him, manipulate him, dominate him. They want this idea passed. So they're pushing it heavily, verbally. All right, here's their idea. Page 122 at the top. The suggestion. Verse 7. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials and the governors, have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. All right, their little suggestion is a lie. Point A1, they state that all the bureaucracy of the province made this decision, and they name him, the presidents, the deputies, the satraps, etc., etc. It was a unanimous decision by everybody. So point two, highlight point two there. The lie lies in the fact that Daniel has not been consulted. He's the one guy that they left out of this plan because he's the victim. That's the lie. Now, as a result, Darius apparently believes that Daniel agreed to this. He doesn't think twice about it, and he thinks it's okay. So what was the idea? Point B1, establish a royal statute. That's just a law. You know, formulate a law, make it strong, king. Point two, make it mandatory, make it strong, not a wimpy law, not a wimpy injunction. Here's what it should be. If anyone asks any petition, if anyone prays, in other words, if anyone prays to any god, and this is a polytheistic environment, any idol, anyone prays to any deity, any idol, or to any man, that would be the priest of an idol. So if anyone goes into any idol temple and prays to the idol or prays to the priest, they should be restricted from doing that because they need to pray, point D, only to you, Darius. They need to worship and pray only to you. Direct it all to you, not to an idol, not to a priest, but to you, O king, for 30 days, for a month. That's the plan. Now, page 123. They said to him, make this thing strong. Don't make this a little wimpy, weak law. Make it strong. So for violation, let's have a good, strong penalty. What's the violation? What's the penalty for violating this law? Capital punishment. Capital punishment. Cast into a den of lions. So that makes it a bit strong, doesn't it? Now notice point one, C1 at the top of the page. The Babylonians used fire to execute criminals. We saw that in chapter 3. The three Jewish guys tossed into the fiery furnace, right? But notice point 2, the Persians worshipped fire. To the Persians, fire was sacred. So they used a different form of execution. They used these lions. That's the key difference between the two. All right, so Darius has to make a decision. Verse 8. Now, O king, establish an injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. Now, the emphasis here is now. Now, now. Don't delay, king. This is such a cool idea and so important that you don't need to think it over. You just need to sign it into law. So they're pressing urgently for this. And notice, they do emphasize that according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians, this law, when it's signed, cannot be revoked. It's permanent and unchangeable once you sign it. And this points out that Darius, the king, was not above the law. This is oligarchy. This is rule by a small ruling elite, right? We looked at that way back in chapter 2. He is not an autocrat like Nebuchadnezzar. He has to obey the law, and if he doesn't, the ruling elite will take him to task. We see this same issue raised in Esther. The book of Esther. First of all, Esther chapter 1, verse 19. Remember Vashti offended King Ahasuerus? She wouldn't come into his party. And so his advisors say, if it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and the Medes, so that it cannot be repealed. There it is again. That Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. The point is, once the king signed this law, it couldn't be repealed. Now, he did the same thing with Haman. Haman brought out a law and said, you know, we need to kill the Jews on a certain date. And that was signed into law as well, sealed with the king's seal. And when the king, when that was exposed by Esther, what was the king's option? The only option he had was to write another law that would counteract the previous one. He couldn't annul it, so he had to write a competing law. So he says to Esther and Mordecai, now you write to the Jews as you see fit in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked. So he has Esther and Mordecai create a competing law. Again, it can't be revoked. All right, point five. We'll close with point five here. Why in the world would he do this? Why would Darius fall into the trap? A couple of reasons. Point A, vanity. Being supremely exalted for 30 days has its appeal, doesn't it? I don't know. I'd like to try it, see what would happen. It has its appeal. So it could have been vanity on his part. But I think more likely, point B, vanity may have played a part, but point B, I think, makes the most sense. It would be a means of getting the Babylonians in subjection to the new government. You know, they had just recently been conquered by the Medo-Persians. And so this would be a test of loyalty and submission. Get them to worship and pray to you. That means they're submissive to you and your government. We'll keep them in order. We'll be able to dominate them that way. So that's probably the main reason why Darius went for this, and this is probably one of the main reasons the government officials suggested it. All righty.
Did Nebuchadnezzar do the same thing?
Could he do the same thing?
Nebuchadnezzar did the same thing, right?
To subjugated peoples? Yes, that's right. Yes, Chapter 3, yeah, he erected that image, and it was a test of loyalty. Yes, exactly. All righty, let me go ahead and pray, and I'll let you guys go right on time here. Father, again, we want to stop and just acknowledge your word and your sovereignty in our lives. And again, Lord, help us to dare to be a Daniel, not only in our place, in our families, but in our neighborhoods, in our place of employment. Because if we don't shine, like Yeshua said, there isn't going to be any light there. So help us to, in a proper and polite and respectful way, let the truth of your word flow out of our lives, in our actions and in our words to those around us, that they may see we're different. Now, we realize, Lord, that that might bring persecution, like it does with Daniel. But to some, we know it's going to bring salvation. So we ask you to give us the strength to endure the criticism and the persecution, but also encourage us by letting us enjoy the joy of seeing someone come to faith. So we lift ourselves up to you in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right, we'll see you next week, you guys.